Welcome to Florida Forum. I'm Paul Leary. Ann Bocock and the crew are off, and Arlene Herson is joining me in the studio. We have put together a wonderful hour for you. Really, Arlene did all the work, I have to say. She's gathered her top 10 celebrity interviews. And Arlene, it's so nice to be able to sit down and do this with you today.
Well, Paul, I can't tell you how happy I am to be here and to share with you some of the amazing people that I have been so fortunate to interview. However, it's been very, very hard to pick the top 10.
I'm sure.
But I have tried very, very hard. So I'd like to share some of my favorites with you and my most favorite, top number one of all time.
Who are we going to start with?
Johnny Mathis.
Oh, he's great.
He has such a wonderful story. I interviewed him actually on television more than 20 years ago when I was starting out on my television show. So now to reacquaint myself with him on the radio recently, he was just wonderful to talk to. So let me tell you how we're going to do this. I'm going to just kind of start, tell you the question I asked, and then we'll run part of the interview. And then, Paul, you and I can comment
okay.
on it at the end.
Great. I'm looking forward to this.
So in this interview and this part of the interview, because there was so much to talk about with Johnny Mathis, but I wanted to find out what it was like at the very, very beginning of his life, and also the fact that he's been a star for such a long time. So I had asked him that so many stars have come and gone, and he's still at the top. And how did he do it?
My mom was the foundation. I mean, my mom and dad both worked so much that we saw them twice a day. We saw them usually when they left for work, and sometimes not even then. But we saw them in the evening when they came home after work, and then started to clean the house and cook and prepare and take care of us. I can't imagine anybody in present day, and I know there are people who do it, but I can't imagine how they do it. And yet they had time for seven each individually, seven children, each one of us. I talked to my brothers and sisters about their lives when they were growing up, and they said, "Oh no, dear, we never felt slighted at all. We just we knew that you sang, and that was about it. But mom and dad were the same as for you as for us."
Wow, interesting. Because your parents worked as domestics for a millionaire in San Francisco, and you became a millionaire before you were 30. But we will get to that. But your father, your first piano, because I think it's so interesting. Because your parents were such inspirations, and all seven of your brothers and sisters, including you, all six of you, I understand, went to college.
Yes.
And, I mean, your parents were remarkable people, but first piano. Tell us what your father did and how much he paid for it.
Dad bought a piano for $25, and, of course, we lived in a basement flat. I think there were nine of us, and we had four rooms. One, two, three, four. Yeah, four rooms. And a little hallway. And Dad had to dismantle the piano to get it in the front door. First, he had to get it in the little gate outside of the front door. And he put it back together, and by the time he did it, it must have been 2 o'clock in the morning. And he sat down and played. And, of course, we had never known our father in any other way except that he went to work and he came back. And when he sat down and played the piano, everybody was amazed, couldn't believe it. And, of course, he just smiled and said, "Of course your dad plays piano."
And, of course, you sing, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, remarkable to grow up in the kind of household that you did, because you became, I mean, from the very beginning, you were not only outstanding talent as a singer, but also as an athlete.
Yeah, well, I guess most kids growing up have a myriad of things that they do. Mine consisted of government type of situation in school. I was student body president and of my junior high school, and then on high school, and I played basketball I ran track and field. I was a high jumper and a hurdler, and as a matter of fact, the week that I was to go to New York, to leave San Francisco and go to New York to make my first recording, I also had an opportunity to go to the Olympic trials as a high jumper. And that was kind of traumatic for me, but 5 minutes with my dad, and I knew where my future lay.
Oh, wow.
And that was in singing. He would he had worked a very long time and had had supported me so much. He so much wanted me to pursue singing as far as I could, and that sort of ended my track and field day.
Arlene, Johnny Mathis.
Well, let me tell you, all I want to say is thank God for Johnny Mathis's father. His parents, as you can see, were absolutely amazing people and supported him in every single way. And he could have been a star. He could have been an Olympic star. But
it's amazing what you find out about celebrities that you never would have thought that they would be something like that. And here they are, a celebrity now. It's amazing how
true.
Life is.
But he's so real. I want to tell one more story, which he told in another segment, because when we were doing these interviews, we did them in 5-minute segments. And there are so many important things that I wanted to include. But one thing that Johnny Mathis told me when he was, I think it was around 19 or 20, his first hit song was Wonderful, Wonderful. And I asked him how it felt when he heard it. And he said, well, you know, when you hear it on the recordings, of course, it's not the same. You hear it, you know you're singing. And one day, he said he was driving in his car. And on the radio, on the car radio, his song came on, Wonderful, Wonderful. And he pulled over to the side of the road, and he said, I'm on the radio. I mean, he's so wonderful. He is so real. And I am so glad that he is still a star.
Oh, that's great. Well, I want to remind everybody that you are listening to Florida Forum on WXEL-FM. And we're talking with Arlene Herson today with her top 10 celebrity interviews. And we're just done the first one, and we're already off to a great start. Who's next?
Well, next is Paul Anka, who is a wonderful performer and has been performing for a long time and still working in Vegas, making a lot of money. And he not only sings, and many people don't know because he hasn't been writing as many songs these days. He's really just been singing songs, but very, very talented songwriter. Now, some of his songs we'll remember that were very, very famous in those days that he wrote the music and the lyrics for. So I asked him what some of those songs meant to him when he was writing them. And the first song I asked him about was Lonely Boy.
Well, Lonely Boy was a product of the 50s. One has to realize in those days, you know, pop music was just starting out, and we had a lot of record hops to do and favors for disc jockeys. And I was traveling around, you know, pretty much alone with whoever was with me, obviously. But we'd go to these hops, and kids would be dancing together, and they'd be screaming at me, and I wouldn't really have any kind of a life as they did. And I just would go back to the hotel rooms and kind of look at myself and say, wow, this has a lonely aspect to it, and I just wrote Lonely Boy.
Oh, my God, nobody would ever think that Paul Anka was ever lonely. Your documentary, which was done years ago,
yes,
talked about your success as a teenage idol. It was called Lonely Boy.
Yeah.
I hear you're considering doing a sequel to that.
We're talking about it, actually. I'm really planning my own TV special that'll be shot in April that'll have, you know, aspects of that. I'm just a little curious as to the how reliable that title would be today. You know, I mean, certainly a play on that, and it was an award-winning film, but I don't know that if I really feel that, you know, that would be appropriate today. But I am doing a worldwide special that we're planning to shoot out of possibly the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas, and that will encompass, you know, a lot of biographical material.
Wow, okay, and certainly not, we hope, Lonely Boy ever
not
again.
Anymore.
Right. Now, what about the song Puppy Love?
Yes. Well, I was writing for a few people when I first started, and Disney had come to us and said they had this young girl that's just killing them all across America, breaking hearts. Her name was Annette. And they put her on tour, the tour that I was on, actually, and I got to know her, and they wanted to make a record, and I recorded an album called Annette Sings Anka that I wrote for her. And at the same time, a relationship, you know, started, and we really got into each other, and Disney was quite concerned, and she wanted to get married, and they were into their imaging, and, you know, told her, look, this can't go that way. And I certainly didn't want to get married at that time. And she's a very sweet girl, and by the way, she's, you know, hanging in, doing quite well today. They kept saying it's just a puppy love, and it just kind of hit me, and I went to my piano and I wrote it for her, and it came out, and it did fairly well for me.
Yeah, great song. Okay, what about the song Put Your Head on My Shoulder?
You know, I was very much aware of the the ambiance of all of these record hops that I would go to as favors to disc jockeys. And, of course, you know, in those days, that was a room full of kids and a lot of ballads, and everybody was holding each other. And I'm up there singing, standing there alone, singing to all these teenagers, and everybody's head was on each other's shoulder. And it was kind of a, you know, it was kind of important back in the 50s, a time of innocence and romance. And if you went to the theater, you just wanted to get that head on your shoulder. If you were making out, get the head on the shoulder. It kind of was part of the equipment back in those days, and certainly something you focused on. And I just wrote the song being aware of how important that whole physical moment was between teenagers. I mean, it's not prevalent today, but back then it was a very important aspect as to the scheduling of your romantic schedule.
Now, isn't it amazing, Paul, that Paul Anka in those days didn't have anybody putting their head on his shoulder?
Hard to believe, Arlene. It really is. What a great guy. I mean, you know, one of the stories that he just was talking about when he had a little romance with Annette Funicello and he thought of the song Puppy Love. I loved that story.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Great
well,
guy.
He's wonderful. And hey, Paul, if you're out there, I'll put my head on your shoulder. Anyway, great performer and so wonderful to have the opportunity to interview him.
Sure.
Now, when we say top 10, it's hard to pick them out. But however, Marvin Hamlisch is a wonderful, wonderful performer, has a wonderful story. But way, way back when he was starting out and he was a rehearsal pianist and he was really trying to make his way into show business, he met a friend. That friend was Liza Minnelli. They were friends in high school. Now, Liza Minnelli became a very, very important part of his life. So I asked him about Liza Minnelli, about the friend, and what the friendship meant to him. So here is Marvin Hamlisch talking about his friend, Liza Minnelli.
Right. She was dating a dear friend of mine, and we all became friends. And I wrote a few songs for her, and I'll never forget, on Christmas night, we went out to her home to surprise her mother, Judy Garland, with these versions of songs, and it was amazing. And I just, it still gives me goosebumps just thinking about the whole experience of having her sing my songs, having Judy Garland hear them, having Judy Garland then ask me to play for her. The whole thing was, you know, something out of a wild dream.
And Judy Garland asking you to spend the night.
Right, exactly.
on blue silk sheets, I understand.
Fantastic. I mean, in fact, they were so beautiful that I called my mother. I said, you'll never believe what I'm sleeping on here. And my mother was so sweet when I came back the next day into our modest home. My mother had bought blue silk sheets, but they were fitted sheets for my bed. It was really sweet. It turned out finally that I didn't really love them at all because you just slip a lot. So I've stuck with the cotton.
Okay. You know, I'm looking right now at a playbill from the Garden State Art Center in 1987. A picture of you and Liza Minnelli.
Right.
I was in the audience. I mean, now you're playing with symphony orchestras and all over the country and with the Washington Symphony Orchestra. But I was in the audience that night, and I will tell you, it was magical.
Oh, thank you.
Magical.
Well, you know, she's been one of my best friends, and I'm looking for her to come right back now and start singing again and all that stuff. I mean, she's had, you know, a lot of problems with her hips and all this stuff, but hopefully all that will be behind her, and she'll be ready to come back again.
Yeah, I sure hope so. I recently interviewed her sister, Lorna Luft, and
right.
I'm glad to see that they're back together
right,
again, too.
Right, exactly.
But she introduced you to the person that gave you your first break.
She introduced me to a fellow by the name of Buster Davis, yes.
Yeah.
And Buster Davis was the man who gave me my first break, which was to, in fact, to work on the Bell Telephone Hour.
Okay, but didn't that also lead to Funny Girl as well?
Yes, he gave me the chance to be his assistant on a show called Funny Girl with a girl by the name of Barbara Streisand in it.
Amazing, isn't it? We see all of these stars and we see them independently, but we don't realize what an effect they have on each other. Liza Minnelli and Judy Garland, for him to have spent the night when
it
he was young at Judy Garland's house. And then, of course, he went on to do such wonderful work with Barbara Streisand. He wrote The Way We Were and has worked with her on many, many things. And one of my favorite shows is actually A Chorus Line, which Marvin Hamlisch did on Broadway, which made him a star.
That was like a breakout show for him, so to speak.
Exactly. Well, nobody knew. He had mentioned, because we talked in another segment, that there was no script. Nobody knew what Chorus Line was really going to be. It all kind of came together as they did it. And some songs, like one called T&A, which which in those days to do on Broadway was pretty gutsy.
Yeah, sure. And now it's a mainstay. It's a, it's just what a great show, and it goes on and on in history. But, you know, I do want to mention about Liza, of course, big fan as many of us are. And I saw her in Atlanta, Georgia over the summer, and it was a great performance. She has had some problems, as Marvin Hamlisch just mentioned, but she's come a long way. She's probably never going to be what she was when she was 30 years old at the height of her career, but she really is just a, you know, almost unsinkable.
Yeah,
really.
I agree. An incredible talent, and as Marvin Hamlisch says, a really good friend. They're still good friends to this day, so nice to kind of hang out with your high school buddies and see that they become successful. Speaking about high school, now my next interview is an interview that I did with Vic Damone, who also I interviewed many, many years ago on my television show, which was called The Arlene Herson Show, and interviewed Vic Damone in the early days when I was starting out. And he was so interesting. He lives right here in South Florida. He supports WXEL. So I wanted to talk to him a little bit about what it was like in the early days and growing up in Brooklyn. And I started out by asking him where he was born.
Oh, I was born in Brooklyn, you know, and I just, and growing up there, you know, I just heard Frank Sinatra records and Tommy Dorsey and Harry James and all the great bands, Artie Shaw and Woody Herman and Count Basie and Duke Ellington, you know, all the great bands. And I liked the music. And then I got a job as an usher at the Paramount Theater, and that's where I loved it there because I would listen to the great bands, you know, aside from, I would really, really neglect my work because I'd be in the back of the theater listening to the music. But that's what I did, and I really learned. I learned an awful lot. It was like a musical education for me. At the Paramount Theater, listening to the bands and how these great leaders like Dorsey and Benny Goodman and so on, how they pace their shows. And I worked there for 2 years, so, you know, listening to all these great stars and artists.
Well, and then you became one of the great stars and artists. Well, I know that this is a story from a long time ago, but Perry Como is a buddy of yours.
Yes,
and so important in your life. And actually, I know him and have interviewed him twice, so you must just tell us, is it really true that you cornered him in an elevator and started
yes,
singing?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I did. When I was an usher there, I did, and he had just finished his show, and I told him that I was a singer, you know, and he said, and I said, well, I said, you know, I take singing lesson once a week, and it cost me $1 a lesson, and we can't afford it, and he kind of looked at me, and I said, you know, we're very poor, and I wish, you know, I don't want to waste my time singing or spending this money because our family can't really afford it. So I said, I'd like to sing a few notes for you if you could just tell me if you think I have any talent. And he said, okay, kid, go ahead, sing. So I sang, what song was it? In fact, it was one of his hit records, There Must Be a Way. And I sang, there must be a way to help me forget that we're through. There must be a way to stop me from thinking of you. And I stopped singing. And he said, why'd you stop? I said, well, you know, I don't want to sing. He says, no, keep singing. So I did. And then I stopped again. He says, will you finish the song?
I was almost going to say the same thing to you. Don't stop. I would tell you that when you talked about school, I just to go back a little bit, back to Brooklyn and high school, you dropped out because your father became ill and you had to take care of the family.
Yeah, when I was 16.
Yeah.
So I quit school to help support my family, and I never got my diploma until about 2 years ago when my manager asked me, he said, okay, you're 50 years in the business. What do you want to do with yourself? What are your goals? Let me know, and we'll kind of plan. And I said, the first thing I want to do is get my diploma. He said, what diploma? It's my high school diploma. He said, you're crazy. I said, no. I want my high school diploma. I feel like my self-esteem isn't where it should be because I feel like I'm a dummy, you know. I want to have my diploma. So he said, let me work on it. And then he got in touch with the officials over at Lafayette High School, Brooklyn, and they worked it out. And I went and got my diploma. I went on stage with my cap and gown and along with the kids, and it was great, you know. Then I did the commencement address, and I explained to the kids how important it was to get an education.
Yeah, and how inspirational. I had read that you said that you sang for royalty, you sang for presidents, Eisenhower and Johnson and Nixon and Reagan and Bush, but that you were always sensitive about not having that high school diploma.
Yeah, I didn't have, like I said earlier, the self-esteem was just not there. And I said to the kids at the end, I said, you know, as I was speaking, I could tell, I'm looking down at all the kids, and I could see there was one kid talking to another kid, and you could see he was, you know, like saying, what does he know? You know, like, let's, what are we doing here? Let's get out of here. You know, I could just feel it. And I said, and by the way, let me explain to you, there might be someone next to you saying, what are we doing here? Let's get out of here. Let's cut class. Or let's. I said, that's the guy you stay away from. He's the dummy. Uh-huh. He's the loser. You don't want to be with him. You want to be with the kid who studies and learn. Don't go cutting class and don't get your education is the most important thing. And go through life with an education and also have God in your life. And just not to be a religious fanatic, but at least always speak to God and always pray to God and thank God for everything you have.
Love letters straight from your heart. Keep us so near while apart. I'm not alone in the night. When I can't have all the love you write, I memorize every line. I kiss the name that you sign, and darling, then I read again right from the start. Love letters straight from your
I mentioned, lives right here in South Florida, and he has his high school diploma and great self-esteem. And interesting, he also has become very involved with a religion called the Baha'i religion, which gives very, very good messages. And one of the messages that he gave, which I still remember, Vic Damone said, in the Baha'i religion, they believe that if you know one person who has 9 flaws and only 1 good point, then you look at that good point. But however, when you look at yourself personally, if you have 9 good points and only 1 bad point, then it's the bad point you have to look at.
Wow. Very deep, Arlene. I love that, though.
He's a very positive thinker now.
I didn't know Vic Damone was a believer of that, but that's great. Yeah. That's really positive, great stuff.
He said that the Baha'i religion has changed his whole life, that he's become very positive about everything, very cool, and it's become very, very meaningful for him.
Well, I just say one thing about Vic Damone. Many of our listeners and viewers know that Vic Damone is a good friend to WXEL, and I had the pleasure of meeting him for the first time a few weeks ago when he came in for a television pledge drive, and he was just so down to earth. I just really enjoyed meeting him. A great, great guy. You're listening to Florida Forum on WXEL-FM, and this is a very special edition because Arlene Herson is here for the entire hour, and she has gone through the archives of the Herson Library, and she has pulled out her top 10 celebrity interviews. And where are we now? We're at about number 5, I think.
Well, it's so hard to think about top 10. Right now we're at 5, and I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to keep it to 10, and it's going to be hard, but what I'm trying to do also, Paul, is talk about meaningful things that celebrities have done, because we see them on television and we think that they all have these easygoing lives and they all have all this money and someone to take care of them, but they're people. Now, my next interview is with Mandy Patinkin. I think this is probably one of the most important interviews that I have ever done, because we know Mandy Patinkin from Broadway. He won a Tony in Evita, which actually a lot of people don't know that that's when he started way, way back then. And he was on Chicago Hope as Dr. Jeffrey Geiger. But Mandy Patinkin has organ transplants. Now, we did a whole segment on how important organ transplants are, because if it was not for organ transplants, Mandy Patinkin would be blind. So I asked him about his experience with organ transplants.
Yes, I I have an eye disease that I discovered 16 years ago called keratoconus, which is the degeneration of the corneas. Our corneas, for all human beings, are like the face of a watch. They're the clear glass that's attached to the sclera of the eye, which is the white part of the eye. And mine were diseased and began to become all scarred, and they begin to become cone-shaped, and you can't see through them anymore. And you can correct it with a hard contact lens for as long as you can tolerate it, but at a certain point, the disease can progress, and the tissue will burst, and you'll lose your eye. So I watched it, and about 2 years ago, actually, for my first eye, a year and a half ago for my first eye, I couldn't see any more out of it, and I was going to lose my eye unless I had a transplant. And to make a long story short, I have the gift of a 13-year-old little boy's eye in my right eye and a 14-year-old little girl's eye in my left eye. I see 20/15 in my right eye, and my left eye was just done 3.5 months ago, and I see perfectly with correction lenses. But one day, in about 6 months, hopefully it'll really correct itself completely. It is an utter miracle. I was very touched by the entire organ donation program and have devoted as much of my life as I can spend toward heightening the awareness for the need for organ donation all over the world. The most important thing I'd like to share with your listeners is the organ donation people want people to know that, yes, you should fill out donor cards, the back of your driver's license, etc., but the single most important thing you can do as a human being in terms of organ donation is to make your wishes known to your next of kin, because oftentimes people don't have paperwork, etc., with them, and as long as your next of kin says you can harvest the organs, then you can save a life.
Yeah, so important and so true and so meaningful coming from somebody like you who is actually experiencing it.
Well, I mean, also, you know, not to trivialize these interviews or whatever, but you know, you interview a lot of people and stuff, and I do interviews to sell this and that. But in this particular case, if you talk about this issue, your time that you spend on this issue, you will have just saved, I guarantee you, at least one life. And in my tradition and in my religion, the Torah, which is the teaching of my religion, says if you save one life, you save the world. And I guarantee you, because of this radio program, someone will have heard this message. In turn, someone will have donated an organ to save someone's life. I can only tell you that in 1997, 5,500 people were waiting for hearts, lungs, and livers. 55,000. And only 5,700 became available, which meant 10 people a day died waiting for organ donation. And we live in a world and a time when no one should die. As a matter of fact, I'm hoping that at one point the laws of the land can be such that the only way you don't donate your organs is if you've filled out a card or your family member tells someone. I would hope that one day it could become a matter of fact.
Good idea. Good idea. You know, I hear that when you had your first eye transplant, you were asked to be a presenter at the Tonys, and that you were at first reluctant to come on because you had to wear dark glasses. What made you change your mind?
Well, what happened was they had asked me to present an award, and it was only about 10 days after my operation. I still had to wear these dark glasses. It was about, I think, even less than 10 days after. And I said to them, listen, I have to wear these dark glasses, and it'll be pretentious if I come on with these glasses. So I have to pass on it unless you will let me say something about organ donation. If you let me explain why I'm wearing these and looking a little silly and make a plea for organ donation, then I'll come on. And they hesitated because they don't like people coming and, you know, speaking for this cause or that. But they agreed. And so I used the platform to heighten awareness. In terms of organ donation, and it just opened up the doors.
Well, thank God you did that. Thank God you left, that they permitted you to do it, and that you're sharing this with us. And I
got such moving letters from people, mothers who are waiting for a heart to become available for their 10-year-old child, hoping that for their 6-year-old child, who they hope when the child is 10 that there'll be a heart available so that their kid can live. I mean, it's just unbelievably touching.
So important, and I hope our audience out there is listening, and I hope that we
you've given the world a gift by asking me that question. They are listening, and they will act on it, I guarantee you.
Well, Paul, again, amazing, such an important story.
Truly.
And Mandy Patinkin, by the way, in addition to giving us all this good advice, he is one of the best stage performers I have ever seen. He was here in South Florida recently, and I know that he comes through periodically, but He comes on the stage just with himself and maybe flowers on either side of the stage, and then magic happens.
He has a wonderful stage presence.
Yeah, yeah, he has a wonderful act and good messages, and we hope the people are listening out there for his message on organ transplants.
Absolutely. You know, we did a whole show on Florida Forum about organ donation, and Mandy Patinkin was talking about it then as well, and it really is an important thing. So all of the listeners out there, again, organ donation, very important.
Right.
Who do we have next?
Well, next we have another woman who is one of my favorites. When you say favorite, she's not only, she's also one of my very favorite people in the entire world, and that's Bess Meyerson. We know her as Miss America, 1945, and she was on television on many of these shows on The Big Payoff and I've Got a Secret for many, many, many years, and then went on to do some wonderful things in her life. But we are going to talk about when she was starting out in her career. She has already finished being Miss America, which is a whole story in itself, and we did a segment on that, but we're not going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about the fact that Bess Meyerson discovered at the height of her career that she had cancer. Now, in those days, people did not talk about it. So we want to hear from her how she dealt with the fact over 30 years ago, and she's a cancer survivor, and she is wonderful. But how did she deal with the fact that she had cancer?
Well, in those years, it was a shocking thing. Nobody mentioned it. Nobody talked about it. You didn't get invited to people's homes if you had cancer. People thought it was catching, and it was a shocking revelation. It was ovarian cancer, which is not a good cancer to have, as though any is. But I had to fight it through. I had cancer. As soon as I left office, I was finished being Commissioner of Consumer Affairs, and I discovered I had cancer. And it was shattering. I can't begin to tell you. I used to walk along the street and talk out loud and say, I'm going to kill you, you cancer cells. You're not going to grind me to dust. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to get rid of you. I'm going to survive, and I'm going to prosper. And I remembered something Eleanor Roosevelt once said when she was in deep trouble, and she talked about a special kind of courage, and I think that those words helped me. She was a model of mine, a role model. You gain strength, she said, courage and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You must do the thing you think you cannot do, and then you're able to say to yourself, I lived through this, I can take the next thing that comes along. And that's what happened.
Well, and you certainly have. And also, not only have you done it for yourself, but you've done it for other people, too. Bess, you've saved lives. Just recently here in Florida, I met a young woman who claimed that she's alive today because of you. Would you tell us about her?
Yes, Annie Bernstein. Well, I then started to speak about it. I didn't go public with it because I knew that my employers would fire me. And I was then doing things that were very interesting. I had left politics for the moment, and I was a consumer advocate, and I was making speeches all over the country. I was writing a column and so on. And I was speaking about it now. I went to the hospitals, and I went to talk to the newly diagnosed ovarian cancer patients, and I wanted them to understand that there was hope. And recently, it was 20-some-odd years after I had cancer, that I spoke at a meeting in Philadelphia, and I said to all those women, you go out, you get yourself tested. I know about the mammograms and the pap smears, but you have to get over to an oncological diagnostician, a surgeon, oncological surgeon, and tell him to examine you for ovarian cancer, because it whispers. It doesn't talk out loud. There are no symptoms for it. There are nothing but sometimes a lady feels she's a little bloated and she can't button her skirt. And then she discovers, no, it's not the diet will cure that. It's that she has ovarian cancer. And there was Anne in the audience, and she went back to Florida, and she went to see the doctor, and she had cancer. She had ovarian cancer stage 2. And she was a fighter. You know, Arlene, in these things that you are faced with, you either become a warrior or a worrier. Anne was a warrior, and she beat it.
Well, Anne is a warrior, and Anne is a warrior who told me and tells everybody that she can talk to that you saved her life. which is really extraordinary.
So I feel very humble.
Yeah, well, and you've done so much for so many people. I mean, you have said that it's an honor to be a survivor and that the accomplishments of surviving cancer is which you're most proud. Well, I'm really proud of you and being your friend.
Thank you, darling.
An amazing woman. I know I've used that word amazing a lot lately, but certainly true with Bess Myers. And she also lives right here in South Florida. And she's been talking to many, many groups here. They all love her. I love her. And with this particular woman that she talked about, Annie, when she told me the story of having cancer and the test that Bess told her to have, she went to her doctor and her doctor said, well, you don't need that test because that test is not covered by insurance. And Annie said, well, how much is the test? And it was $75. And she said, I want that test. Bess Meyerson said I should have that test. Give it to me. And she's alive today because of Bess Meyerson and that test. So Bess is wonderful and very inspirational, and I'm so happy to say that I'm her friend and that she lives right here in South Florida. Now, just on another note, Paul, we have an interview with Shirley Jones, who has also been one of my favorite performers, and she started out very, very young. She was very, very lucky. She became a big star. She's handled it all beautifully. She then, in later years, shouldn't say later years because she's still married to him, even though it's been on and off, married a very crazy guy called Marty Ingalls. But, and I also said to her, but you're both so different.
Well, we are that. You know, we've been married, we've known each other now for 23 years, I guess, married 21. And when they say opposites attract, that's truly the case here. You know, we're very, very opposite. But the thing that we have in common, I think, basically, is our mutual foundation is the same. You know, we both love family. We both love to laugh. We think alike in the ways that are really important. And I think maybe that's why the marriage has lasted.
Well, you wrote a book together called
We did.
Unlikely Love Story.
Right.
I actually tried to get a copy of that book, and it's all sold out.
Really?
Yes. They said that the publisher has to reissue it again.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Anyway, your courtship was described as outrageous and romantic.
Yes, that it was.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, Marty's a very, very romantic man. He loves, he's a Pisces male, and he lives... He's a big dreamer, so he, you know, that's why the romance is very important to him. And our first date, he picked me up in a motorhome. Wasn't a limousine. It wasn't a Rolls Royce. It was a motorhome, and drove me up the coast, all the way up the Pacific coast, up to Santa Barbara, where we had dinner with candlelight and flowers and caviar and champagne, and beautiful music. And instead of going into a magnificent restaurant, we had our own little house with us.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you actually had this wonderful dinner in the motorhome?
Inside the motorhome. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's, hey,
yeah,
if anybody's
it was beautiful.
What
it
a wonderful
beautiful.
Idea.
Yeah. It's lovely. And, you know, obviously, it's one way to get to know somebody. You know, it's little things like that. When I first met him, I met him December the 1st, and that month, New Year's Eve, I had a party to go to and couldn't see him. And when I came home, there was a huge poem sitting on my doorstep. And the poem was just so beautiful, you know, that, I have it framed and, you know, in the house.
Can you share a little bit with us of the poem?
Well, I can't say it word for word, but it was, in essence, I would rather be with you tonight than anybody in the world. And even though it was all rhymed, it was all him, you know. I miss you, and I wish you were here. And in 19, whatever it was, hopefully you'll be a part of my life, you know.
Oh, nice. Gee, if he proposed, I'd accept.
I know. Well, I'm telling you, it was that kind of thing. And there was always little presents and flowers and whatnot, you know.
Oh, okay. Now tell us, you know, you and Marty, you're so creative, but tell us about the Candy Kitchen.
Well, it's an old candy store that's been in Beverly Hills for over 50 years called Edelweiss. And it was owned originally by one family. And Marty's sister-in-law, ex-sister-in-law, who lives here now, and his niece, decided that they wanted to, they were interested in buying it. It was up for sale because the family, I guess the members of the family decided they didn't want to handle it anymore. But it was very successful, and truly the candy of the stars, as they called it. Everybody from Frank Sinatra to Barbara Streisand had accounts there. And so his sister-in-law came to us and said, would we be partners? And Marty gave me a candy store on Valentine's Day.
Oh.
Instead of a box of candy, I got a candy store.
Wow, okay. Just one quick thing before I've got to say goodbye, because Marty has said about you, it's hard to conceive a human being such as this consummate lady who can somehow live and function in a world of flowers and frenzy and see only flowers. Is that so?
Well, that's his version of me, but yeah, I guess I'm not pessimistic, in other words. Right. I'm pretty optimistic about everything, you know, so I think that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah, well, I see flowers when I think.
Well, that's what he's trying to say about Shirley Jones, because she is optimistic. I see her as flowers instead of frenzy, because she's married to a guy that's really full of frenzy, but interesting relationship between Marty Engels and Shirley Jones. Now, let's talk about another relationship, Paul. The relationship of Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. Totally different. They started out together. They've been performing together for a long, long time. But when they started out, I'm a member of the Friars Club. Steve Lawrence is a member of the Friars Club. And we all remember George Burns, who was at the Friars Club all the time. And when Steve Lawrence was starting out, he asked George Burns advice. So this is what George Burns said to Steve Lawrence.
Yeah, George, well, you know, like when you spend time at the Friars, as you by now know, of course, you know, you're all seated around the tables, they congregate and they chat, and everybody talks about what is of interest to them. And very often I would be invited to sit with the older comics, which I was very flattered to do that. And George, we got into talking about, because he related to me, because he said, you know, you're one of the few kids around today that works with his wife like I did. So I said, yeah, we were just talking about how you keep it fresh. And he said, one mistake that Gracie and I made many years ago, and I'm only telling you this so that you don't make the same mistake. I said, what's that, George? He says, well, when they were in early radio, they were doing newlywed jokes, because they were, in fact, newlyweds, like they were in vaudeville. And after a lot of years, they were still doing newlywed jokes, and it didn't work because the audience didn't believe it. Because here, these people at that time, they were married 10, 15, 20 years, and you can't do newlywed jokes when you're married for 20 years. So he said, you have to grow up with your audience. And because those people, when they come to see you, they relate to you where you are, because most of them are at that same point in their lives. And so as they grow older and have children and subsequently grandchildren, and they're talking about grandchildren, you still can't be doing newlywed jokes. So I said, boy, that's a terrific comment and a great observation. And Edie and I have been very cautious and careful not to break that law.
Interesting, because your audience is growing up. I feel I grew up with you.
Well, that's for the most part, the people that are in our audience are people that we've all grown up together with. And, you know, we're fortunate enough where they bring their children and to see us, or we get a lot of younger people in recent years, I've noticed, been coming to our concerts. But basically, the bulk of that audience are people that grew up with us on late night television or through records over the years. So the conversation that we have on stage with our audience, if they're listening to it, it can't be something like, the newlywed joke or something, you know.
Right. Okay. But you and Edie grew up together. So what happens since you live together, you perform together, you're together all the time? What happens if you have a disagreement? And then you have to go on stage.
Well, that's really happened. One of the best shows, one of the most hysterical shows ever, that came on the heels of a fight that we had in the dressing room. And we had a marital fight like most married people have, and you just can't turn that off. I don't care how good an actor you are, you just can't shut it completely off. Well, we walked out on that stage that night. We were so hostile towards each other, she to me and vice versa, and I said everything to her that every husband has ever wanted to say to a wife, and she said the same, whatever wife ever wanted to say to a husband. And the audience was hysterical. That thought it was part of the act. And here we're getting all our hostility out, and this audience is hysterical. And after an hour of releasing all these pent-up emotions, it was like a psychiatrist. We came off fine, and then fine. We unloaded our problems on them, you know.
Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, we are certainly glad that the audience can be the psychiatrist for you, but they are still performing. They've done their farewell act, and then they've done one more time.
Are they really performing, you know, still?
Yeah, well...
I'd like to catch that act. Right. I've never seen it, but
we'll
I'd
see.
Like to catch it.
They are wonderful, and I hope that they'll keep performing forever, but interesting stories. Anyway, speaking about interesting stories, Paul, Debbie Reynolds was on the show, and Debbie Reynolds was, as a young woman growing up, was in a very, very, very poor family. She said that when her family originally came to California, that they lived in the park, that they were actually homeless. She was actually homeless two times, once as a child, and then once later on, which we're not going to talk about in this segment, but where she lived in her car after one of her husbands took all of her money away. But that's another story for another time, and we will run that segment. But what I wanted to talk about with Debbie Reynolds today was when she started out. I remember her first singing in the rain, and the story of how it started. She did not know how to sing or dance, and she was working with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor, and one day when she was very miserable because this was all new to her, Fred Astaire came along and was very helpful to her. So I asked her about Fred Astaire.
Well, he was a good man, a very sweet man, and when I went under contract, I made Singing in the Rain. He was rehearsing next door, and I was working with Gene Kelly and lots of teachers and Donald O'Connor, working so hard, and I was terrified because I had to learn all this so fast and keep up with those brilliant dancers, and I had never danced, so it was just terrifying, and I was crying under the piano one day at lunchtime. Mr. Astaire walked by and said, "Who's under there?" And I was crying away, and he said, "Now, Debbie, you come and watch me rehearse, and you'll see how hard it is for someone that really knows it." And he never allowed anyone to watch him rehearse. So I went in with him to his rehearsal hall, and he let me sit there and watch him become frustrated and sweaty and red in the face and throw his cane. And I saw how hard it was. And he says, "Now you go back in there and rehearse, because this is how hard it is, and this is the way it is, and this is how you're going to have to suffer through it. And in the end, it'll be worth it, because what you'll learn, it will be precious to you all the rest of your life. So just get in there and sweat and stop crying."
Well, Paul, what do you think?
Debbie Reynolds, I mean, Singing in the Rain. Is there anything else?
Well, but can you believe that she didn't sing or dance before that?
It is hard to believe.
And we know so much about Fred Astaire, who left us a long time ago, who was such a wonderful entertainer. But now we know more about Fred Astaire and how helpful he was to Debbie Reynolds.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad that she went through all that hard work and those sweat and tears and rehearsing, because, boy, I mean, she's a great star in all the films that she's made, and they called her the unsinkable Molly Brown.
right, definitely unsinkable, and especially where she started. I mentioned that she was homeless and very, very poor, and when she started out, she entered a beauty contest in her hometown, this little town she lived in, and the reason she entered the beauty contest was because they gave all of the girls in the contest a scarf and a shirt, a blouse, and she did not have her own new blouse. And that was
amazing.
The beginning of it all.
Absolutely amazing. Well, I want to remind everybody that you're listening to Florida Forum on 90.7 WXEL FM. And Arlene Herson has gone through the archives, and these are her top 10 celebrity interviews. And it's hard to believe that we're already at number 10. Do I hear a drum roll?
And I saved the best for last. Well, I shouldn't say the best for last, because I like them all.
Yeah, these aren't really in order of the ones that you like the best. They're just your top 10 ones that you thought were fun.
Right, but I like to give meaningful messages. And Phyllis Diller, we see her on stage, we see her as a comic. We've known about all of the work that she's done to keep herself beautiful. But to keep herself beautiful inside, Phyllis Diller told me that she read a book that Liberace gave her called The Magic of Believing, which changed her whole life, because Phyllis Diller, believe it or not, did not have good self-esteem when she was starting out. So I asked her about this book, Magic of Believing, and how it changed her life.
Well, everything seemed to be overpowering to me, and I had absolutely no faith in my own talent. I mean, if someone said they didn't like something that I did, then my God, I would never do it again. If I played the piano and some guy said, oh, you better go back to the drawing board, I would just cringe and that would be the end of that. In other words, I was easily deterred from anything I would be attempting to do. If I drew a picture and someone said it was ugly, I'd tear it up and go cry. Do you understand?
I understand, but what amazes me is that you're an artist, a concert pianist. You get up there and make people laugh. You put yourself on the line all the time to be criticized
That's true.
A performer. So how did you get around it?
After I read The Magic of Believing, that wonderful book, I decided to protect myself from the ever-present negative influences out there. And what I did mentally in my mind, I created a white feather cape. Now, this is mental. In other words, you know, water off a duck's back. Boy, picture that. Nothing. Feathers are totally impervious. You can't even fireproof them. They are so impervious. So, this was my mental protection. I decided that I would pay absolutely no attention to all the negative things that people throw on you day after day after day, especially if you allow them into your secret desires, if you tell them that your dreams, if you tell them what something you want to do, they will throw a negative arrow. I'll give you an example. I was working for a very rich man who owned the radio station, and he took me to lunch one day and said, what are your plans? I said, I'm going to become a comic. Now, listen to what he said. He said, isn't that a rather audacious plan?
And you said?
I didn't bother at all. I'd already had my white feather cape.
Oh, okay. So when did this come to you? This book, The Magic of Believing, which I have in my hand, and I promise you I am going to read. But when did this, at what point in your life were you able to turn the negatives into the positives?
When I read the book. That's when I was able to turn myself completely around, 360 degrees around, from complete negative to complete positive and impervious to negativity from other sources. Because believe me, you will run into them until you've simply risen above all that negativity. See, they'll kick you when you're down. Before you've maybe gotten yourself into a nice, secure place, everybody knows more than you do. When you're a beginning comic, everybody who comes in and looks at you has a better idea of how you could be better, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A guy came in to see me one time in Hollywood, and he was the vocal coach for the troupe of Porgy and Bess that were on their way to Russia. Big deal. He came in and saw me one night at my very beginning. He said, oh, your phrasing is all wrong. I'll come past tomorrow and give you a lesson. All right, get this. He came to my little house, and he gave me some pointers and told me what I was doing wrong. And as he left, he borrowed money for the bus.
Oh, my God.
Does that tell you anything?
Oh, my God.
So, see, advice is worth what you pay for. Believe me, you don't take advice from people who don't know what they're talking about. No, nobody can advise you except you. You must go with your own feelings. The more you become, the more true to yourself you are. Don't be afraid to be different, because that's what will make you great.
Oh, I love it, and I'm going with it. I have a quote from you that I read recently that says, I wake up every day happy. Hot damn, I say, it's a great day and can't wait to get going. Is that still the truth?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, good. Well,
yeah, there are a lot of things out there to be done and fun to do them. And you know, I enjoy what I do.
Well, aren't those good messages from Phyllis Diller?
Absolutely.
I must say, if I could wake up every morning and say, hot damn, let's go after
I'm
that
with you.
Day.
You know, I actually particularly like this interview. You know, I've gone through your archives and had to put some of them together for engineering the show. And this particular one, that she got this book from Liberace and it changed her life, is so inspiring to people and to me especially. I loved it.
I interviewed Liberace many, many years ago on television, and Phyllis Diller many, many years ago, again, on television. And Liberace is the first one to tell me about the book. And there is a new version of the book out, at least there was at that time, with Liberace's picture on it, because he's the one that said it affected his life most of all, because he, like Phyllis Diller, also had self-esteem problems. Mm. So it's called The Magic of Believing. And,
Paul,
I think you and I have got to read that book.
Well, okay. We'll read it. And we'll report to you right here on Florida Forum. Arlene, it has been a wonderful hour. We have been listening to the top 10 interviews of celebrities that Arlene Herson has been interviewing for many years on this show and others here on WXEL. And it's just been my pleasure to sit in with you, Arlene.
Well, thank you, Paul.
And I do want to mention that Arlene has a wonderful new website. It's www.arleneherson.com. Would it be anything else? But it's a beautiful website, and if you want to learn anything else about Arlene, any information about the celebrities she's interviewed on TV or on radio or just what she does in her daily life, it's a great resource. And can you talk about the website for just a minute?
Well, it's the first time I've had a website, and I have been so fortunate in that I have interviewed hundreds of people on television and on the radio. I started on television in 1978, believe it or not.
And there are some pictures from your TV show, and you can tell it's a few years ago.
Right, but 78, but I have not been off television since. There's such a thing called reruns. We now call it syndication. I have been so fortunate, Paul, in that I have gotten to talk to so many famous people, and I can ask them whatever I want to ask them. I'm in control.
Powerful.
And I have learned so many interesting things about people, and you'll learn more about me if you go to www.arleneherson.com, because no matter what it is, no matter where I am, I'm going to be doing something new and different all the time.
Well, thank you, Arlene. This has been a wonderful hour. You've been listening to the top 10 celebrity interviews of Arlene Herson here on Florida Forum. Florida Forum is a production of WXEL-FM. The executive producer, head writer, and host is Ann Bocock. The associate producer is Denise Sears. I'm Paul Leary sitting in today. And for all of us at Florida Forum, please join us again next week.